Hey guys, it's Red Switch, the podcast with me, Adamia, Bart.
Hey.
And Oiva.
Moi.
This week, we will be discussing another three different topics, from Twitter to something to do with web design.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay. This Thursday... it wasn't a great day for Twitter. Perhaps the only good news being that, you know, that they exceeded the expectation from last quarter, the growth rates. And obviously we all know about, well, I don't know, do you know about the Vine dying out on Twitter?
I heard something like that. Yeah. They were going to sell it or stop it?
Well, yeah, they've stopped it. On Thursday, they stopped it. So do you know about this, Oliver?
Yeah, I heard about it.
When?
When did you hear about it? Tell me.
So Vine, for those who don't know, is just basically a 6-second clip, and Twitter have it's no longer on Twitter, which is kind of weird because Twitter wants to increase its video content through live streaming and stuff, but they've got rid of Vine, which seems like almost a backward step, perhaps being from the fact that it's also laid off 9% of its workers. So my question is...
9 or 90?
9%. 90% of his... Did I say 9?
Yeah.
I meant 9%. 9% of its workers have been laid off. Is that the correct word?
So like a tenth?
Yeah.
Okay.
That is correct. 9% is approximately very close to 10%, yes.
Yeah.
My question is, Twitter downfall, is it going to happen? When's it going to happen? Let's find out.
Roll intro music.
Okay, so intro music's gone. It's died out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm gonna go back into it now. So Twitter was launched. Do you guys know when it was launched? July 2006. And by 2012, it had 100 million users, averaging around 300 million tweets.
It went through a few stumbles in the beginning as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because originally when it took was getting traction, it had this very serious problem that their servers kept crashing. And it was known as the fail whale. Because whenever Twitter servers crash, they redirect you to a page showing this kind of whale that's upset.
Yeah.
And they got a really bad... they started to get a really bad reputation for it. That they constantly start failing. And so they made it their life's work that within that year, they became one of the most consistently running sort of websites out there. They went from crashes every day for a few minutes to no crashes for years on end. So when they faced problems before.
Yeah.
I don't think that that there's any reason to think that they're not going to overcome the problems they have now either.
Well, like, for example, the users, the advertising revenues are continuing to fall for Twitter. And perhaps its biggest concern is its shareholders have voiced concerns about the problem with Twitter. And if you didn't know that, the CEO is actually a head of two companies. So he heads Twitter and Square. And they're kind of like, you know, that. The Twitter's so big now that they want him to just head one company. And I'm just wondering whether you guys think that, you know, for me, in a personal sense, that I'd probably use Twitter the most out of all social media accounts. I don't know whether you guys are the same, maybe Facebook for you, but...
I've never really gotten into Twitter. I follow a few people on it, but I haven't fully understood why you'd limit it to 140 characters. So that's never really stuck with me. And so people that really like Twitter, they seemingly really like that limit and the way that works. But it hasn't really jived with me, and so I've never gotten into it. More of a Facebook person.
Yeah, well, I'm not a big fan of Facebook, perhaps because I think there's just too many things just coming on. And Twitter is very simple, just a scroll, and you're scrolling up and down. They've added a lot, like, more features now, where it's like moments and stuff where you go on. But I don't really do that. I just kind of just scan through. And it's mainly to do with, I don't really... follow any sort of people as in friends that much. I don't really care what they're doing that much. I'm caring more about sort of news, and news seems to break a lot quicker on Twitter. on Facebook, I have to kind of like, to get that news, I have to pretty much unfriend all my friends. And I think Facebook's more to like communicate with friends for me, whereas Twitter is more to just sort of look at out in the general world. But with the fact that Vine is a big thing, I think, you know, it's underestimated what kind of impact it will have, because to remove something like a Vine, and they're saying, you know, that they want to go in the direction of live streaming, I don't know how really viable that is, because Vine is pretty big. I mean, you know, on Facebook has Vine, and it has like videos and stuff.
But you can expect that they wouldn't make a choice like this to shut down Vine if they hadn't run the numbers a lot and seen that it's probably much of a like a fad kind of thing. Like it was good for a couple months when it came out and it became quite big, but I don't see much Vines anymore.
Well, Vines has been around for several years.
Just 6 second videos. They've been around for a while, but I don't think they're extremely popular anymore.
I think the popularity has gone down because like many things in the social media sort of frame, it hasn't evolved really, has it? It's just stayed as a 6 second video. It hasn't really had any sort of, and to be fair, you can't really evolve it any further. It's a 6 second video. You can't really make it 7 seconds evolution. Wee. So I think that was actually one of the main reasons why Twitter said that it wasn't evolving, and they just dropped it. You know, even though Vine still has 100, like in its peak had like 100 million users, and but mainly I think that with Twitter, I seem to be going on it less and less recently because of these sort of I feel like Facebook. Every social media account has that peak period. Like on Facebook, when it was probably, I felt, 2012, 2013, 2014, when I spent most time on it, when all my friends got on it, you know, and it was like exploring new things. And when it gets overcomplicated, when it gets overly advertised, there's loads of adverts on it, you almost think it's not cool anymore, you know. So I think Twitter, like, I feel like Facebook has had its time, really. Personally, I don't think Facebook is growing as quickly as it was. Even though the numbers might differentiate, I think I don't think it's doing as well.
If there's one thing that Facebook's doing now that I think is really cool, it is the Facebook Live feature that they've been rolling out. Honest to God, there have been times where I came on Facebook just for the reason that someone I wanted to see was live at that point in time.
Yeah.
Like the band just says, oh, they're live for a second. And you know, there's like this very cool thing of this uniqueness of I can see them at this point in time right when they're broadcasting, instead of a video that's always going to be there. I feel somewhat special that I managed to watch it when they were making it.
Well, Twitter
has something very cool about that feature.
Yeah, Twitter have the partnership, I think, with Periscope, and Periscope is pretty much the same thing where you can go live.
Periscope started in most of it.
Yeah. Periscope was like, but I've never been a big fan of them personally, because I feel like
I think it's very cool. It's aiming to go back to the days to feel a lot like what you had in the old days of someone you look up to or a band or someone you're a fan of, seeing them in real life when you usually never get the opportunity to do so. A unique experience where you're really part of something as an observer, as a viewer. That's kind of been lost in the age of YouTube, where everyone's a viewer and it doesn't feel like anything special. With Facebook Live and with Periscope, you can somewhat feel unique because you're there when it happened. You were watching. That's completely new.
For me, something like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, they started off with a certain target. So Twitter was, when it started off, just, you know, writing tweets, 140 characters, very sort of snappy. And it was actually called like the SMS of internet in like 2013 by some people. And Facebook was very much friends related, you know, you can talk to friends, you can set up parties. And YouTube was very much sort of, you know, just watching videos and live streams as well. And I feel like all sort of accounts are now trying to like spread and like have literally everything. So Twitter wants to have videos and streaming, and so does Facebook. And I don't think all of them can survive because at the moment it's going to get to a stage where Twitter and Facebook are the same thing, really.
Mm.
because you can talk to your friends, you can like direct message on Twitter, you can do everything on Twitter, and you can do everything on Facebook. And then you probably have the same thing on YouTube as well, where you have like a YouTube account and you like videos, you can stream as well. And surely it will come to a point where everyone, like that platform, you can do everything possible. Meaning that if all three of them have the same, or all four of them have the same thing, one of them will have to die out because it's competition. There's too much competition and you can't really, you know,
have it, a... It's a problem right now that Twitter and Facebook are two very distinct networks that have... They overlap in some sense with what they do, but mostly they're... You go to them for very different reasons. And so they're not sitting... They're not in the way with each other. And everyone can have both a Facebook and a Twitter. But... as they start creeping up on each other and implementing similar features and mimicking each other, then people are more than they are now going to start deciding between whether they want to be on Twitter or on Facebook. And that's a big deal. They're becoming more of a threat to each other by emulating each other.
Yeah. You know, it's not, you know, like something otherworldly to mention that, you know, a social media account can just or social media platform can completely, you know, go downwards. Like MySpace, you know, had that, you know, when it, you know, lost all its customers. And it's not necessarily to do with how well it does, it's just chance. And I feel like it's not going to be like, oh, Twitter does this better than Facebook. I think it will come to a point where certain people will just go towards one of the platforms, and that will sort of cut, like, start the death of the other platform. It won't be that, oh, Facebook is doing well and Twitter's doing badly because Facebook has got this little thing. It will be a very small little thing that will give Facebook the advantage. For example, MySpace was actually not that bad. The problem was it wasn't evolving in the right way and it just didn't seem cool. Facebook was this new cool thing and people thought, ah, screw MySpace.
Well, then I've got a question for you, which is that all these networks always are constantly evolving and it changes and from what I remember, the first social network I was really on was YouTube at like 2008, 2009, 2010. And at that point in time, it was one of the biggest social networks out there, bigger than Facebook at the time. And you could see these very old YouTubers that have been on it creating videos for 10 years already, that said that in the beginning they had a small amount of viewers, but every time they uploaded a video they had maybe 300 views, and 150 of those views, those people actually responded, and not just with comments but with video responses. The amount of interest that audience showed, the amount of engagement was far greater in this tight-knit community back then than it is now. Now you've got millions of views and proportionally less engagement. You don't have a lot of viewers turning into creators every once in a while. And my question to you is, all of these networks are constantly evolving and changing based on how many new people are on it, based on the features. These changes in features and whatever, will we ever get something that's truly new, or is it just people going almost like fashion, deciding sort of for 1 year to be on Twitter and 1 year on Facebook? Is there anything new about what's happening, or is it just alterations of interaction online?
Well, you know, it is a bit like fashion, but I feel that the only way you can truly have a platform where it is very much sort of very sort of personalized, where there is a good response and there's not that much bullying going on, is the fact that a lot of people have about 15 Twitter accounts, and it's like there's almost too much in the market, where Twitter might say it has 313 million users right now, but how many of them have got multiple accounts? On Facebook, I'm pretty sure people have like two or three different Facebooks, one for friends, one for whatever.
Well, I'd say with Facebook it's less so, but I do notice that almost everyone I come across who has Twitter, they have their private Twitter and their public Twitter, their private Instagram and their public Instagram.
Same with YouTube. Some people have like the actual like YouTube, and they have like this thing where they do their dodgy stuff and search random stuff and have it private. And I feel that the only way you can get full disclosure upon, where you can have a good conversation, is almost like you have a platform where you only have one account, so everyone knows who you are. Or if you don't want people to know, you're completely like private and you don't, no one knows who you, it's like a passport. You're not gonna fuck about with your passport, are you? Because you only have one and you can't really do like have seven or eight, even though people do have seven or eight, you know.
What you're telling me reminds me of sort of going towards a platform that's more real in terms of using your real name. It's not anonymous. And do you think that that sort of an anonymous internet where everyone's just interacting without sort of without any ties to their real life, do you think that's a lost cause, or it's not as interesting as sort of being the real you on the internet?
I think personally one of the big problems why people do get turned off social media is social media bullying. And I feel that the way it's basically looked at by Facebook and Twitter is very poor. So it's not very good at regulating bullying. And I feel if you just have one account, whether it's private and you don't want anonymous or not anonymous, you're only allowed in some way, you're only allowed one account, then it will be harder for people to get targeted in a particular way. It will be harder for people to have multiple identities where they're basically cheating the network. And sometimes it's very boring, you know, when people have four or five different accounts, you know, who am I to believe when they're tweeting four or five different things, sometimes contradicting each other?
Yeah.
What is there to hide is what I say. What is there to hide? And if there is something to hide, make yourself completely anonymous.
Well, if that's the kind of opinion you have, where you can solve a lot of problems by everyone having their real name tied to what they do, look up OneName, which is this thing that people are trying to start, which is that you create one identity on the internet with your real name, connected to your passport, get verified by the government that it's really you. And then you've got this little cryptographic stamp that you can put on anything you say to verify that it's you. It's sort of the verification badge on Twitter, but then sort of several magnitudes more advanced. And the idea is that you tie all your social media and everything to this one name, so that to avoid identity fraud and emulating someone or imitating someone, to prevent all of that. People are going towards this thing that might pick up, who knows, it's very early days at the moment, called OneName.
Yeah.
Have a look into it. Should we talk about something else?
Yeah.
So, I want to just have a rant about stuff that annoys me. And what annoys me is web designers. And I'm going to explain to you exactly why web designers are horrible.
One second, aren't you a web designer?
Yeah, but I'm one of the few good ones. I'm a good one. Okay.
So bad web designers.
They're bad guys, mostly good guys.
A vast majority of web designers. I don't know if it's actually a vast majority, but I'm just going to assume it is.
Say 85%, just to like...
85%.
Okay. I'm going to fact check you.
I ran the numbers. It's 85. 85%. Okay. So, web designers come in. Like, when you have big companies, those web designers, yeah, they're fine. But for small businesses, when you're starting out, and especially nowadays, the one thing you need is some presence online. And to do that, you need a website or you need something similar. And so you go to web designers to do this for you. And this puts, there's a very big imbalance between a person who wants a website and a person who can make one. Because most people don't know how websites work, how to make them, what goes into it. So when a web designer gives you an estimate saying that, oh yeah, it's £600 to create a website, that sounds fair. You don't know if that's actually how much it costs. You don't know how much labor goes into making one of these things. They're really ominous and sort of mysterious. And this gives web designers a great opportunity to get away with doing practically no work and getting lots of money in return. Take this, for example.
Hello, my name is Bram and I'm from the Netherlands. I work at a phone shop and we hired some person to make our website.
So the person they hired to do their website spent a lot of time making small, minute changes and didn't really do much about it. It was slow and there didn't seem to be any improving. He just said that he couldn't do it.
Whenever we needed some special changes to our website or new features, he would always tell us it's not possible.
Anytime they came with new features or had new stuff to be done, the web designer said, oh no, that's not possible.
This led me to believe that he's just not able to do anything because he doesn't know how to. After looking into what the website was made of, I discovered that it was based off a simple WordPress template.
Now, a WordPress template is a very simple thing you can find online. This is usually meant for people who want to make a website themselves without having the knowledge to do it. You go online, you browse through pages of example websites, you pick out the one you want, and you customize it to what you want it to look like. Very easy, anyone can do it. And so web designers that just want to get lots of money for a little work do the same exact thing. They find a nice template online, buy it, or get it for free in most cases, make little adjustments to it, and then charge you £500 for it, £600 for it, £10,000 for it.
He had changed a few photos here and there, but you could see that he actually didn't know how to program at all. We found all of this by looking at the source code, because he hid the fact that it wasn't his own work.
Throughout the source code, he kept making slight changes to obscure the fact that he got this template from somewhere. It took us quite some time digging through the internals of this website to find patterns and to search that on Google and to eventually find the template that started off with, which was £60.
In total, we paid around 1,500 euros for not a very good website at all.
He sold them this website for 1,500. That's pretty easy. One day of modifying a website, adding a few images, changing stuff around, and hosting it for about maybe £20 a year, and you get £1,500 out of that. Do that a couple hundred times, and you're sorted.
He made sure to keep control over the servers, so whenever he wanted the change to happen, we had to go through him.
Another notable thing that these web designers do is they make sure that they do all of the stuff related to maintaining this website and keeping it online, so that whenever you want a change to happen, they're the ones controlling the website. You have to go through them. You can't get them to do one job and then own all of the material so that you can get a different designer to come in and change it anymore. They make sure that they're always stuck with you, leeching off you, getting your money every time you want a slight change.
Long story short, he's no longer our web designer anymore.
The problem with websites a lot of the time is that they give you this false sense of professionalism, or that it seems like a great business because their website is good. But really, a good-looking website is a few clicks and maybe £10 away for anyone to do. And how can you find out whether a company is real or not? It's very tricky to tell that from the website. What you can do nowadays with a bit of money can make you seem like a lot, can make your company seem a lot bigger than it actually is. And it's a great way of deceiving people. So not only web designers are causing a lot of trouble here, but also small businesses or people that are trying to make a lot of money from others put this fake image online of their company to appear bigger than they really are in order to look professional. Oh, look, go to this great website. This is ours. You can do all of this stuff. You can see what we, sort of the kind of work we do. And in the end, again, it's just a template, something that's been laid out for them that they didn't have to do anything for. Swap out a few images here and there, and they seem like one of the best companies around.
Hi, my name is Haroon, and I'm a business owner. Quite a while ago, I was getting some work done by a consultancy company. I noticed there's a lot of shady things kind of about the company. The guy who answers the phone sounds exactly like the CEO of the company, but every time he claims that to be some other employee, he mentioned, I guess this is to make himself look bigger, he mentioned all sorts of other employees that I'd never met in person or ever spoke to. Basically, I had this feeling that they were being completely honest, that they weren't actually completely honest with me. I wanted to find out more about them.
This is where I come in. Haroon came to me and showed me the company's website. He wanted me to look into the website to see if I could find out anything from it.
Basically, their website looked really good, very professional. It made them look kind of very credible.
After quite a bit of digging around, we discovered that the website was based on a free template. The template was intended for estate agents, and you could just fill in some of the blanks and off you go. You look like a professional estate agent.
Yep. If you basically compare the template to the actual website, you see that they hadn't changed much at all.
Just like the actual website, the homepage of the template had the exact same display of photographs. And rather funnily, the about page, which lists all of the employees at the company, they left in the fake names that you leave on the template on their actual website.
Yeah, I believe the one employee that particularly stuck out was some lady called Lara
Stenger.
Stenger, that's the one, I think, yes. She basically, her name, the spelling, the font, everything was exactly the same on the template, as well as the, and even the picture, actually. They hadn't even bothered to change the picture. So yeah, you had the name, the picture on the template, as well as on the website of that firm.
When you look on the real website, with the same exact photo, they have Lara Stenger as an employee at their company. A completely fake imaginary name that you're supposed to fill in with your own employees. They fill in with a template. They didn't even feel like changing the names to other fake names. So at this massive consultancy firm, they've got the director of media, Lara Stenger, who's made up, who's literally the same as on the template. You can't make up the degree to which these people are faking a big company just by having a nice looking website. It's insane.
So yeah, you had the name, the picture on the template, as well as on the website of that firm, which I thought was quite actually ridiculous.
And just like with my other friend Bram, Haroon did not continue doing any business with this consultancy firm. It's so easy to portray yourself as something bigger than you are on the internet. If anything, a website which looks like it's been made by someone who doesn't really know how to code, it's probably a lot better than a website which looks like it's made by hundreds of people.
Yeah, get your point, but I think there's a lot of fraudulent behavior in general. And I think there's a very fine line between sort of making yourself look good and full on lying. So for example, you say that I can do this and, you know, these are some of the things I've done. You can make it seem that you've bigged yourself up a little bit, like in a CV. You're not going to like be completely down to earth. You're going to like put something nice on there and make yourself seem maybe a bit more than what you actually are. But when it comes to a point where you're just straight up lying and making up things like, oh yeah, here's the head of advertising, you know, that's jail worthy. That's fraudulent behavior.
They had Peter answering the phone.
Yeah.
Who has for some reason, the same exact voice as the CEO. And every time Haroon sort of brought this up saying, you are the CEO, aren't you? And he kept denying it. No, this is Peter. Creating this false image of professionalism because they clearly couldn't be professional enough being honest with the client, which to me just tells you that their only plan, their only way of succeeding is through deception.
Well, the probably one of the major principles of any consulting company is fiduciary, which means trustworthiness between the clients and the actual consulting firm. And if the second you break that, you're not really a consulting firm anymore. It's just fraud, fraudulent behavior. You can't really do much about that other than report it. And I do get the point of, you know, like those, I don't get why people use web designers when you can just use a web designer, like a builder, a website builder. What's the point of going up to a web designer, paying so much money to them to make something that will look, unless you've got a really sort of particular way your website needs to work and you can't find a single template. If you've got just a general website, why not just build your own website? I don't get, like, there's a lot of platforms out there.
Yeah, just take it from me. I am a web designer. Yeah. This is the work I do for people.
Yeah.
And in most of the cases, it is much easier to try and do it yourself first before employing someone who is going to take a lot of money and take a lot of time to do something which is only slightly different from what you could get on a template.
Yeah.
It's very unproductive and it's very expensive and, in my eyes, not worth your time. What will be great, and this is starting to build up, it's not really there yet, but in 5 years you can see this being commonplace, is internet services that create websites for you using artificial intelligence. You dictate to them in a natural language exactly how you want the website to look, and they're building AIs that can interpret that and design a website for you. They write code for you. In a couple years, my expertise, which is web design, I'm going to be made redundant by robots.
Well, the thing is, that's the whole idea, I think, with AI, that even though you can type in something, what you want something to look like, I feel that there's a part of you that if I explain something to you, what I want, and you draw it out, it might be completely different from my own picture and my own description of what I want. So for web designers to really go completely out of work, there'll have to be some sort of system where, like, some machine that reads the neurons in your brain and realize the exact picture you're thinking of, and then it displays that on the website. I think we're very far off that. Mm. So don't worry, but you're not going to lose your job.
It's not about every single web designer ever losing their job, but just the vast majority of things can be automated. We've already found that the vast majority of websites to be designed can be done just by templates. And now even slightly more specific and more particular designs can be done through AI. And eventually, my job sector will be reduced down to big companies who are primarily running on the web that really need actual designers and actual developers to work for them.
It's very similar with something like banking as well. They make up very, very big words, big terms to make it seem like the common man won't understand what the fuck is going on. You know,
exactly be thinking,
what the hell's going on? And they even charge consulting companies extortionate amount of money to give advice on a very simple financial transactions. And they do very similar behavior. And many people think that the future of banking itself is going into sort of the electronic, and Google might become the biggest bank because it's very similar. People are realizing the fraudulent behavior that's going on in banking.
And this is effectively a really good thing, what we're going to see happening. It's going to make people more independent because they're going to have better information available to them through these AI systems, through these systems that really can understand what you're telling them, and they can give you the right information back, or they can create the right website for you without you having to go through these very deceptive companies that thrive primarily on the fact that their customers don't know enough about the area to do it themselves. This asymmetry of information is going to fall away very soon, and I, as much as it's going to land me out of a job, I'm really looking forward to it because it's a great step for technology.
Sounds good.
I'll have to find
something else to do.
And, I'll have to put some effort into that right now.
Yeah.
But
so the moral of the story is basically, if you need to design a website, go to a website builder, don't hire Bart.
Yeah, don't hire me. Don't hire me.
Okay, I won't.
Well, I'm the one maintaining the Red Switch website. You can see that's horrible. You should just get that with the template. No,
website looks a lot better than the Red Switch.
Red Switch was also actually a template. I started from the template with that, yeah.
I have a template for my website.
They just work.
They look fine.
They're fine.
I changed it. It took me like a couple of days to like actually change it up because I changed it completely. I wasn't like...
But you're not fluent in programming, and even you can do that. Yeah, it's a very easy thing to do.
But WordPress is just like quite simple, really.
It does the job.
Yeah, it does the job.
What's the UI?
Web developer designers use, apparently.
Clearly, yeah, that's from the stories, that's what they use. Oh. What say you, Oliver? What do you think of all of this?
What say you, Oliver?
What say you?
Yeah, it's funny.
You're speaking the truth.
A friend of mine is learning to program, and they start learning from web designing. Dead end.
Yeah, the big problem with these coding schools nowadays and is learn how to code, trying to popularize coding to teenagers and children, is that the thing they usually start with is stuff like web design. Learn how to create a website, learn JavaScript and whatever. These things are not going to stay around for too long. The technologies themselves are going to stay around, but they're going to become highly automated.
The human race is... I think the most important topic you need to know about, rather than going by the trend of what is awesome right now, is predicting what you want to do and how that would affect the future. Because the whole idea of 10 years ago, the top job right now did not exist. So 10 years from now, the whole idea is take the gamble and do what you like. Because a job that you might think, oh, it pays really well, I'm going to go into this sector right now. By the time you're 35, 40, you might be out of a job. Because you might be replaced by robotics, or it might not be relevant anymore.
Hmm.
You know, should we...
Rude boy.
Should we talk about something else?
Man.
Charge, what do you want to talk about?
I want to follow up on my last week's topic. I've always found fascinating reading other people, maybe drawing to the sidelines just to understand what the situation before getting into the social situation myself, right? And learning about oneself has always been a big thing for me. I like developing own skills and being an individual in that way, not depending on others and their skills, but rather getting there and understanding most things. Maybe one of the reasons why I got into philosophy eventually was because I enjoy the big picture as well as I enjoy the minute details I find in things. And as far as I know, the more I study, the more I get interested about stuff. Yeah. Bar?
That reminds me a bit of what we were talking about last week with your segment. That there was one kind of conversational style which you mentioned that was similar to that, that liked the big picture but also the great details, a somewhat in between an analytical and a
intuitive.
And an intuitive speaker.
Yeah, it was the functional one. So a lot of people would find them tedious and they're lecturer types. Yeah. But I don't know. I like the big picture and I'm often thought as impatient. Like people who are patient think I'm impatient. But then I tend to think other people are impatient and I'm patient. So I don't know what to think really. Maybe I am just scatterbrain. I don't know. But those four different conversational styles somewhat align with the four temperaments that have been since like ancient cultures. But only last century, there was this great psychologist, psychoanalyst actually, who was a college graduate with Freud. Actually, he studied with Freud. And they did psychoanalysis together. And the funny thing is, Freudian psychoanalysis is the one that's more recognized, even though Jung made just as much psychoanalysis of his own, which was leading to another path. And his idea of psychoanalysis, instead of going to the sexual organs, was modeling people and fitting everyone into very accurate details and descriptions. So eventually there was these two psychologists who, by the cognitive theories that Jung led, made a theory called the MBTI, Myers-Briggs Test Indicator, and 16 personality types. So I'm going to talk about those.
So Freud's kind of psychoanalysis stemmed from something to do with sexuality primarily, and Jung's was more based on categorizing people's behavior,
decisions, their like alignments with their own fundamental project of their themselves, like how do they want to live their lives. Yeah.
And so what led on from Jung's work is the Myers-Briggs stuff. That came,
yes.
that originated from, yes. his original ideas, which were based on temperament. That there's something that distinguishes people, or a separate sort of some way of categorizing people's behavior. That people have a distinct temperament.
Yes. So I'm going to explain what the four different temperaments are. One of the most obvious that without any psychology comes to everyone is the difference of introvertism, called actually introversion, and then extrovertism, which is actually extroversion. So the contemporary idea of what an introvert is and what an extrovert is somewhat false. The original psychoanalytic concept of introvertism and introversion and extroversion had to do with energy levels. This sounds very anime-like.
You get energy if you're an extrovert. You get energy from social situations, and if you're an introvert, it takes energy away, or you get energy from situations where you're with fewer people. Is that right?
Not necessarily. So introversion. introversion and extroversion as energy types are just the way a person processes different situations. Social situation is one of those, but there's also interests that you can do alone. Like an introverted person might spend enormous amounts of time reading, studying, and really getting into some one subject. Instead of an extroverted person might get impatient, like the last week's intuitive type, because they don't get the big picture. And they get lost, so to speak, in the details. And then they get bored, might fall asleep. And so it's not only social situations.
Yeah.
But social situations has to do with that as well, because there's the other temperament type difference, judging where some people judge by this idea of like fact-based concepts, and the other one is more like a feeler type that has beliefs and want to be affirmed of those beliefs.
So what's the distinction, if you can describe it as simple as possible, between, is this a division again between one group of people and another group?
Yes. So
introverts and extroverts, and then separate from that, you've also got.
Because it's always been wonderful calling someone an introverted, and then this introverted person has a huge amount of other introverted friends. So wouldn't that be a contradiction on the behalf of like typing introverts as a social outcast? Because they introverts often find other introverted people, and then they become more social with those. So it's not about social situations in that sense.
I guess extroverts know fewer introverts if the extroverts hang around with extroverts.
Yeah.
So to them, it seems like the introverts don't have any friends because they don't have the same friends as the extroverts. Mm. It might be just a matter of perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And extroverted... So extroversion can also, as an energy level, be thought as something that... Okay, I'll go to the next one. The next temperament type will probably open this up more, which is a perceiving temperament type. So the division is, again, made into smaller bits of people who use a sensing function, cognitive function, instead of intuition functions. A sensing person would be more keen on physical activities and using their bodies, and an intuitive person is more into their mind. They might really live in the mind. Like an intuitive person often is very clumsy, can hit walls, doors, and hit their toes on whatever sides of beds.
Sometimes all at the same time, walls, doors, and everything.
Yeah,
simultaneously.
So here again, a introverted intuitive person is very social when they get into conversations and discussing about topics of interest to them. So studying, study groups, often the intuitive person is the social magnet, sort of. Yeah.
But when they're in a group of friends and they're around a group of people that they don't really know well, they become extremely clumsy, right?
Clumsy, or they might seem cold as they're more analytic about things. Like, exactly. So,
it's interesting to hear this because usually when I think about personality typing and categorizing people, I think of it as a sort of absolute where you're one personality type, you act in one way all the time. But how you're describing it is very much based on context, that a intuitive, introverted person acts a certain way in one context and a different way in another. Much more, in my opinion, that sounds much closer to the truth, where, you know, we as beings interact in different ways based on the context, or based on the place we're in.
Okay, this goes into a very deep philosophical issue. I'm not going to talk about the philosophy, but there's an issue with thinking that there is a inherent identity that everyone has, but that's not true. Everyone is all the time in this kind of flux change. Everything is changing throughout the everyday. You won't be doing the exact same things all over. Whenever you go about your everyday life, you go into new situations, and then you have to learn and adapt to that. And that's kind of like the human experiment we're going through with. So it's all about behaving and having those cognitive patterns of yourself mapped out to learn how to resolve this new situation you are faced with. So what I think is important is learning about the different differences between cognitive functions and understanding what cognitive functions you prefer to a situation, and that way relieving some of the pressure of the intimidating situation. So you won't be as scared of some new situation that you don't know how to handle, because now you know that the way other people handle it is completely different. And the way you do it, you can really kind of try to master the way your cognitive behavior works in different situations.
So is having some understanding or some intuition for characterizing people's personalities and thinking how people respond to reactions, is that a way to overcome some anxiety that you have yourself in these
definitely. Situations?
It's like if you become aware of the fact that everyone has, or everyone is responding in different ways, then you might feel less anxious to respond in a particular way yourself.
Yeah, much like last week I was talking about the conversational styles. When you learn about the different conversational styles, you become aware that the fact that you just simply are not cut into some of them. And if you do want to be able to have any sort of conversations and really excel in some of those, for let's say a career position or being able to study in groups, or being able to have a relationship, very intimate relationship, with understanding the other person deep on a deeper level, having more meaningful relationships. All of those things come down to the fact that you have to yourself learn about the different types. So you can't just stick on to one identity, your own behavior all over. You have to learn the other ones. You have to learn the differences, and then you have to find ways to experience the different functions in yourself. So everyone has all the different functions or cognitive functions in them, but the other ones are sort of like deeper, and they're harder to grasp. So I think there's a massive confusion in people thinking that everyone is same, everyone thinks the same way, but that's not true.
So it's not a characterization where I occupy one box of many possible boxes, but it's just that there is one way of behaving or a set of ways of behaving that comes more naturally to me than others.
Mm.
But it's not exclusively those behaviors. Yes. You tend to be able to...
So it's like you're subconsciously choosing which box you want to go for a particular situation. So you have a stimuli and you, without knowing it, subconsciously choose what you want to.
Yeah, so it comes down to like growing up, education, your childhood. Like Freud says, and throughout your life, you change your fundamental ways in some ways and you grow. Jung agrees with that. He's not opposite of the other psychoanalysis. He just remodels it. And there has been some researches that show that throughout your life, the cognitive functions you use are already there when you are like few months to 1 year old. So you're already set in your first years of life. So it might be scary, but if you just learn to understand the different functions you use and prefer. So everyone prefers one single function over others. And some people are fortunate enough to find and understand the second and third functions they prefer, and then trying to master those as well. So it all comes down to learning them and then developing yourself to sort of like your full potential. But obviously there's not an end to that, so there is no full potential.
So is the only way to go through and learn more of this and effectively mature, is the only way to do that through this theory and through understanding the theory behind of it? Or is there a more practical way to learn it that anyone, even people not aware of this of this system behind it, can mature? Is there a thing you can try and do during your day-to-day life?
Surely there's almost an infinite amount of different possibilities.
Yeah.
There's so many different situations that you're faced with. And for you to almost go against your subconscious nature, you have to almost force yourself to act in a certain way. Surely that goes against just general human nature. And if what would be the point of someone actually doing that, going against that and displaying different things? Like, you know, going thinking, okay, I'm gonna actually act like this in this certain way.
I don't think that's possible. I don't think just anyone can strip off their pasts and just become completely something else. But yeah, you're right. There is an infinite possibilities of different situations. That doesn't mean there's no pattern in them. Like there's always some sort of framework you can apply to everything, and this is exactly it. You just modeling the different framework of different cognitive functions, and they're not set. They're not like this is that and that is that, and then there's nothing that can change them. That's not true. Any single person can sort of become more adept at the different cognitive functions. And I think what's important in understanding is that the functions weren't meant to only type people into strict one personality types, but instead show that people prefer one or the other way. So it's only dividing the situations to first into half, and then those halves to more halves, and then more halves and more halves. So in a way, there's still not...
The intention was not to be divisive, but to be informative.
Yeah, and it's not conclusive either. So it's a very interpretive study. And that's probably one of the reasons why Jungian psychoanalysis isn't exactly like mainstream science, because mainstream science tries to have conclusive, objectified knowledge. This is very subjective.
Well, trying to model the psyche, the human psyche, is, you know, it's a very tricky task.
Pretty much impossible.
Yeah, this is...
There's no definitive answers, but given that there's no definitive answers, that doesn't mean you can't have any useful answers. Mm-hmm. What you're arguing is that these theories or these ideas about human psychology are useful for your own development and for your own maturity and in becoming maybe a more fuller person, if there's even if that's even possible.
I think humans are very bad at analyzing qualitative data in general. When they have something that they can't quite quantify, they almost brush down to the carpet and say, oh, that's not real science, I can't really do about that. Or say something like, that's just what I am, that's just what it is. Because they don't see the reason behind it. And if you do understand the you know, and expand yourself. So I don't think it's as boxes. I think there's a lot of overlap between, you know, personalities. If you almost, the idea is to be a more of a broader person and know what kind of person you're dealing with rather than just sort of be within your own psyche and say, this is the kind of person I am, I can't change, and be a bit more open to change. And that's the only way you can really move forward.
Yeah, exactly. That's the sort of thing I'm trying to get here. Like, personality or people in general are more opaque, So there's not a single person is one set thing. They're all constantly changing, and they're constantly changing how they behave in some things. So this comes back to the issue I was saying, that it's a deep philosophical issue with sciences and philosophy really fighting at each other. Early 20th century philosophers talk about phenomenology where we should be describing experiences, and that goes into a very interpretive subjective knowledge again. So there is no set absolute truths out there. It's just how you experience those things in your life, and at a very face value, everyday experience way. So there is no ready set things. There's only this thing, that's this experience that's coming at you, and then you behave in some way into that, but it's ultimately your decision how you behave in that situation. And people prefer one or the other thing, and that's the point of cognitive functions. You will prefer to be maybe energetic or not energetic about something, and then that's already one big difference.
I think we should discuss more about this
next week.
We should continue. Yeah, there's so much you can go into.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to talk about the cognitive functions more. Yes, I've read Jung myself, and I probably will bring the book and maybe try and showcase the book as well.
And we could get someone with a really nice voice to read parts of it.
Yeah.
Genuinely, just invite someone here.
Okay.
Sign out.
Do I do that?
Yeah, you say goodbye to the audience.
Okay. Well, guys. No, yeah. Not guys.
Guys?
Or guys and girls.
Bart's train is leaving, and he is going to murder me if I don't end this soon. This was Red Switch, the podcast. Thank you for listening, and hear you next week.
Bye.
Bye.